Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks. This is Rachel Morrissey. I am the executive producer of Breaking Banks and the FinTech Five. After doing 200 episodes, we are taking our first official hiatus. However, we have collected so many interesting interviews that we haven't always been able to include in our episodes, we thought we would use them during this time. First, I have a few conference announcements. We are very excited to be doing a live show from the Mobile Payments Conference on August 28th to August 30th. Brett will be on stage with Travis Delaney, CEO of Push Payments, and Dan Gonzalez, VP of the Payment Industry Relations for the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. So use the code MPCPUSH100 and get $100 off of the registration cost. Finovate returns to New York City September 11th through 14th with an expanded Finovate Fall. Register now at fall2017.finovate.com and make sure to enter our special partner promotional code BREAKINGBANKS20 to save 20% on the current ticket price. Next Money Chicago is September 26th. Many of the Breaking Banks family, Brett King, JP Nichols, Ron Shevlin, Jim Roos, Jason Henricks, Dwayne Blomstrom will all be speaking there. It will be a FinTech powerhouse day. You can register at nextmoney.org. Registration is open for BAI Beacon, which will be in Atlanta on October 4th to 5th. They have a particularly interesting track that they work with Matteo Rizzi, who never disappoints. Our listeners can use the code B32 to get a discount on registration. And we are looking for a sponsor for the event, so please contact us if you're interested and I can give you the lowdown on the goodies you'll get if you sponsor us. And last but not least, we will be the exclusive podcaster for Money 2020 Vegas, and we are pumped. Breaking Banks, FinTech 5, The Serial Entrepreneur by JP Nichols, FinTech Snark Tank with Ron Shevlin, and FinTech Global with Gayla Boscovich will all be there. Also, Brett King and Ron Shevlin will be on stage. The entire team will be at The Pod doing mini shows throughout the event. We are being graciously sponsored by NTT Data, so shout out to them, NTT Data. They get stuff done. Check them out at nttdata.com. All of this is on breakingbanks.com on our sponsors conference page. Now, on to the show. We're starting the show with Brett's interview of Sergey Sergienko, who is the CEO of Chrono Bank, and they are creating an entirely new payment ideal for wages.
Okay, so we're here with Sergey Sergienko. Sergey is the CEO and one of the founders of a new banking service called Chrono Bank. You can check them out on chronobank.io. He has won numerous awards for business. He's actually based in Australia, so it's very early for him there because we're doing this recording. He was included in the Hot 30 Under 30 and Young Guns in Business, and he's represented Australia at G20 summits. And he's deeply involved in the crypto and ICO space. In fact, his startup, Chrono Bank, raised $5.4 million with an ICO back in February. So that's big news. So, Sergey, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Yeah, thanks, mate. Appreciate you having me.
Yeah, so thanks, mate. You've been inducted into Australia. Thanks, mate.
No, that's right. Well, I've been here 21 years, I guess.
Oh, 21 years. There you go. Yes, it does rub off. Very cool. So, where in Australia are you based?
Sydney.
Okay, cool. Whereabouts in Sydney?
We're good. Well, to Castle Hill, which is, I don't know if it tells you. So it's a nice little green area. So it's for the kids and to go to school at.
I was in Brighton, La Sands and San Susie when I lived there in Sydney.
That's a good area, except for the planes. Yeah. I guess they come the other way though. But yeah,
no, I used to actually have this. I had this place. I could sit up on the roof and I could watch them landing at the airport, which was pretty cool. But
that's pretty cool. Yeah.
So let me tell me a bit more about Chrono Bank and what you guys are doing.
No, well, the idea came around. Basically, like, it goes back to the time banking, right? The original idea of time banking, which is like over 200 years old, right? And what we're trying to do, we're trying to make transactions between employer and employee without the fiat currency, essentially. So in other words, if you work for an hour, you just get paid an hour and you spend that hour, as opposed to converting it into dollars, right? Then paying the bankers along the way and then spend it and paying the transaction fees along the way too. So essentially what we're trying to do, we're trying to make the earning and spending of the cash a little bit fairer.
Is this tending towards a bartering system? Or?
Like you could say bartering, but it's not really. Like, I mean,
it's
bartering,
just value exchange, trading.
Yeah, the bartering is hard to... it's hard to go into fractions with bartering, okay. You know what I mean? Yeah. So essentially,
right. So you've
just
created these tokens called labor hours, LH tokens, right?
That's correct.
So that's essentially a cryptocurrency.
That's right. So there are a couple. Time is a good one and a fancy one, and that's the ticker on exchange, right? And labor hour is the product of that software we're trying to create.
So you could essentially have a contract with your employer and you could be paid in labor hour tokens, LH tokens.
That's right. And the reason you would do that is because of the technology, what we can do, we can settle an hour as it is delivered. In other words, you come to work, right? And instead of waiting a week or a fortnight for a payday, right, you actually get settled as it's delivered. So in other words, you work for 8 hours, you worked 1 hour, and it's already into your account. Okay. If there is no order to cancel, so it's pretty kind of revolutionary and pretty cool.
Yeah.
And as far as what also is great about it, right? As far as the third world countries are concerned, the pensions, the workers' compensation insurance, and the taxes could all be built in automatically in the system. And that's what we're trying to do, and that's what we're trying to negotiate with a couple of countries at the moment.
So tell me about the progress you've made so far. How long's your team been working on the concept, and where are you at in terms of commercialization?
So far, we just we got a bit better of the wallet, right, to keep the tokens in, right, and the exchange between the time tokens, labor hour tokens, and fiat, and we're just testing that. We should roll it out within a couple of weeks.
Wow! Right?
And after it, we're starting to create an exchange for labor. In fact. So if you think of order book on a stock exchange, right, so on the left, like on, you could be a bids and asks, it would be something similar. In other words, the employer would come in, say, I want 10 people, and employees on the other side would come in based on their reputation. They would charge different amounts, and they'll come in and they would bid to deliver the work.
Now, you plan on having a debit card associated with this as well, I understand.
That's correct, yes. Now, we're like talking to a few guys. I mean, Talking Card is one of the guys we're talking to, so in terms of partnerships.
Okay, so that would be, so when you swiped your card, it would essentially convert your LH token into Australian dollars or euro, or whatever the local currency
right.
is.
Well, okay. Yeah, that's right. That's okay. The idea.
So tell us a little bit about the technology. Obviously, you've got blockchain behind it, but tell us a little bit more about the technology behind the stack.
Right. Now, that's probably a question for our tech guy, right? But essentially, at the moment, it's an Ethereum token, right?
So you're using Ethereum-flavored blockchain then?
For now, yes. We are, however, looking at adding to it, and we're talking to NEM a lot.
So NEM's coming up more and more. You know, I've just been asked to advise a new startup that's doing an ICO that they're based on NEM. So it's interesting. These guys are getting a bit of traction.
NEM, see, the thing with NEM, right, is Lon is a good friend of mine, right? So he's between Malaysia and Sydney, actually. Mm-hmm. So he spent some time there and here and there. And I mean, the guys just like, you know, they hardworking guys, they just get in and kind of do it. And I mean, like, that shows. I mean, like, they just without kind of, like, you know, too much hype or anything, they're just making a good product.
I hope you can give us an intro to those guys. We haven't had them on the show as yet, but given that I'm hearing more about them, it's definitely getting interesting. So
it's a very good. They realize the multi-sig capability very well, right?
Which is, of course, the whole debate that's going on around Bitcoin right now, and blockchain version 1.0. And of course, we got SegWit coming up, the 17th, right?
That's right. Well, you know, like Bitcoin, that's interesting. You know, I'm sure there are a lot of nervous people around the world at the moment. Especially after what happened yesterday, but you know, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's what makes it fun, right?
Why Sydney? Why is Sydney the right place to launch? This organization.
Well, Sydney, first of all, because we're here. Secondly, because in Australia, what we have, right, and a lot of people, well, are, maybe they do realize, but a lot of people here, what we have is the labor laws and the labor setup, rather, is one of the best ones and fairest ones in the world, right, because of all the unions back in the day and everything, right? So when, for example, in America, you got minimum wages like in the region of like, you know, some like in hospitality of like $3, $2 and all this tipping culture, here we don't have that. Here, like a waiter could be expecting to get paid $20-25 an hour just because he's a waiter, you know what I mean? Yeah. And that and like all like workers' compensation works pretty well here. And the system is kind of like that. So that's what I would like to see the rest of the world being close to, you know what I mean? So that's a good starting point. In terms of like real starting point, it's probably better to hit it with a third world country, like something like Papua New Guinea or something,
right?
You know, where people don't have anything.
So, I mean, we've got this interesting situation now where, you know, previously in Australia, the lack of venture capital and private equity was a real concern for startups like yourselves. But
that's correct.
The ICO, is that given, is that a way you see startups being funded when you're in economies that don't really have private equity or venture capital?
It's all global now, right? But the problem, I mean, you're right about Australia, right? Here, unless it's dug out of the ground or unless it has bricks on it, right, people are not interested. And it's very, very, very weird, right? Like, considering, like, we look at our culture here and it's very strange. I mean, you'd expect people to be a little more kind of risk, like not as much risk averse as they are. Now, in terms of ICOs, well, it's the first time in the world when a bunch of geeks have enough money to fund whatever they need and work on interesting projects, you know what I mean?
Thank goodness for geeks.
That's right. And it's, like the way I look at it, right? It's a great equalizer, right? Because then you don't have this, let's call them stuck-up bankers, right? Sitting there and deciding the fate of potentially a world-changing idea, right? So you just go out and do it. That's epic, and that's what I love about the space.
How are you going in terms of recruiting employers onto this platform, or what's your distribution strategy?
We have a couple of companies of our own, right? So they're on the platform, but we haven't started the large-scale marketing yet. Yeah,
that's imminent, given that you're a couple of weeks away from having the platform at a beta.
Well, definitely. I reckon within 2 months we should be all right. I mean, from the point of employer, right? They get a quality, they get quality labor that they can trust, you know, and that's in our day and age, that's pretty. And that's pretty scarce.
Okay. So tell me about your team. How big is your team that you've got behind the bank?
I've got about 15 people. I've got about, 10 developers and the rest marketing and relations, public relations. And
so, I want to ask you this question. Having been through this cycle, myself and I know my mate Josh Grish from Simple, we both decided, for two reasons. One is that from a millennial perspective, the whole bank branding wasn't necessarily positive. But having bank in the name was also an issue for some regulators, even though we had sort of come up with a solution, I think, in the US would have allowed us to be branded as Movin' Bank and execute. In the end, it was just easier for us to drop the moniker bank from the name. So, what about you guys? Have you had any pushback or resistance because of the name?
We're in a new economy, regulation, what's that? I heard that word once or twice. Nah, at the end of the day, right, the legal entity is not actually called a bank. A bank is just a website at the moment, you know what I mean?
Okay.
Like Krona is in reference to time, bank in reference to the cash.
Of course.
In terms of banking, that's right. But to tell you the truth, I mean, if you're talking about fairness, I mean, it's pretty unfair.
But as soon as you issue a debit card, that's going to be a potential issue, right? If people think you are a bank.
That's right. That's why, like, a lot of the debit cards in the space, like, if you look at the debit cards for Bitcoin cards at the moment, I mean, it's very vague in terms of branding of the card. At the end of the day, like, you know, the new age is here, and the banks will have to do something about it. I mean, and they have to kind of live with it or deal with it somehow. And I mean, if you start, like, I know what you're saying, right? So they get a little bit upset if you represent a bank where you're not a bank. Right, but I mean, like the project itself, the other name for it is LaborX, which is Labor Exchange.
Okay.
So, and that's the branding that we're going to go with as far as the debit card is concerned.
Okay. All right. Cool. you know, what's your timeline in terms of what are you expecting to achieve this year?
Well, we should have a beta for the labor exchange by hopefully December, January. Mm-hmm. And then we just get on scaling and getting people on platform.
Fantastic. So what else can you tell us about, you know, where you see this playing out, how you see this developing in terms of, you know, what would be the ideal scenario for you in respect to adoption of this?
Well, the ideal scenario is to do a trial region in some third world country, right, and show that it can work and show that it can help people, right, and then basically scale up from there. Like I said, and I can't stress it enough, this is a system that would bring like, you know, pensions and workers' compensation to the third world, to people who never, like, you know, who never actually got paid anything, you know. It's, and that's kind of invigorating to think about it that way. And I mean, I hope we kind of succeed in at least, like, you know, changing someone's life in that way, where they can actually get paid for the work they do, as opposed to being screwed over like they always do by their governments or by the employees if they have one.
Yeah, I mean, we are starting to see a lot more sort of real-time salary models coming out. You know, Uber has launched a real-time salary service. Drivers can get paid 3 times a day.
That's right, because when you think about it, right, the system that we have currently, and that's what everybody uses, like when you say salary, right, it's usually quoted a year or a week. And the thing is, under the pretense of false stability, right, when you say, okay, you got like 4 weeks annual leave and you got 8 days sick leave, people sign up to the salary, right? But in fact, like when you think about it, it's nothing more than slavery. I mean, like I say, like under the pretense, because I mean, the stability, it goes only as far as your contract goes, you know what I mean? Like maybe 3 months of separation payment when you finish work, right? But a lot of people kind of depend on that. Now, if you ask someone, would you rather just get paid kind of more and allocate it yourself, or like, you know, click a button and it allocates everything for you in terms of holiday pay and everything, and you get more per hour, and nobody is making money on your services per se, you know, so it's like...
It does allow people to cater for variance in, you know, their cost of living, you know.
That's right.
If you could go along and, you know, like, for example, if you suddenly get a phone bill you're not expecting, or a doctor's bill might be a better analogy, you know, be good to say, well, let me go out and work for 3 hours so I can pay the bill. You know,
exactly, and
be able to do that all in real time. The current system with sort of getting paid every 2 weeks or every month, it's just an arbitrary, classification.
It was based on industrial age, like, you know, which is like 150 years old. You know, like that's what it's set up on in the current age. I mean, like people, like it's a lot, like all these propositions become a lot more attractive, right? When you think about it in terms of like the freedom that it gives people, you know. So like when you think about it, if we're talking about the labor, right, who's digging, like say call it digging trenches, right? Well, I mean he could dig trenches like, you know, like in many really region, right? And there's no, like, I mean, I can see why it gets paid differently in different regions of the world, but I mean, like with the labor, I mean, if he's a mega digger, like he should get paid like a mega digger as opposed to the guy next to him who's pretty shit digging, you know what I mean? No, like so.
You can't say that. We're on the AM radio, dude. You can't say those sort of words on the AM. So listen, where can people find out more about Chronobank and the whole concept of labor hours tokens and the labor exchange?
No, yeah, I'd love, basically sign up to our Telegram group, sign up to, like, just go to our website and all the links are there. So it's chronobank.io. And I'd love to kind of, like, you know, answer and address any questions that people might have.
Very cool. Well, listen, thanks very much for joining Breaking Banks today, and keep us informed of your progress. We'd love to see how it rolls out.
I appreciate it, mate.
Next, we have Brett's interview with Brad Livingston, the CEO of Street Context, who is trying to solve the problem of content noise. This is what I thought we were trying to do.
So at this point, we'd like to invite the CEO of Street Context, a new asset management startup looking at mid-market research and so forth. Brad Livingston's the CEO. Brad, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
So tell me, you know, how did you guys get started with this business, and why do we need a different approach to research?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. So my background, really quick, was you know, first working on the brokerage side for RBC in New York, World Bank of Canada. Then got to, you know, kind of have a great experience with some really smart folks and go to a firm called IEX, you know, which was building a new stock exchange. And I think I got to see kind of the, you know, the two sides of the street from a broker point of view, which is, you know, really helping a client decide what to buy and then helping them actually buy that thing, right? So, you know, if you're looking at buying General Motors, you know, choose a bunch of research, analysis, call with analysts, you know, perspective, et cetera, help you come to a decision on whether or not you want to buy that name, and then helping you actually buy that name. And, you know, got to see firsthand the effect of electronic trading on execution and really the commoditization of the value of execution. And while that was happening, see this explosion in content production. You know, traders were now starting to put out notes as much as they were actually, you know, trading, and there was a lot of value to clients. And, you know, Wall Street's this world where it's a world of extremes, right? So on the electronic execution side, you know, they're, you know, burning logic onto chipsets. They're, you know, building radar towers to shoot orders. They're actually even talking about building a particle accelerator to put them straight to the earth. But then on the communication side, they still use email, AOL Instant Messenger, and fax machines. And so our big insight was, well, why can't we take the, you know, the exchange structure and really apply it to content, right? And build a global content or really knowledge exchange for the industry, which is kind of what led us here and what got us here and what we're working on now.
Very, very interesting. So where are you guys based?
So we're based in Toronto, which is where I'm originally from, but we now have an office in New York and Boston.
So, you know, there is sort of this large commoditization of information and a lot of talk about things like fake news and so forth. So how do you assess the trustworthiness of information that goes onto the platform?
Yeah, yeah. So there's two great questions in that question, which is, number one, you know, what is information worth? What is content worth? And number two, how do you qualify that content? How do you assign quality criteria to it? So I think, you know, on the first one, I think the interesting analogy that we use, which I actually received from the CEO of a major asset manager, a global asset manager, was research is kind of going through what the music industry went through. And, you know, historically in the music industry, people used to, you know, do live shows in order to generate demand for their CDs and labels and records. Right, so they do the live shows and they make the money on selling records and CDs and all this.
Sure,
and then
sure.
Music went through a transition with the digital evolution, where now people actually give away their music and they give away the records and labels, you know, via Spotify and Google Music, to generate demand for their in-person and kind of live events. Right, and that's where they make the real money now. And research is actually going through the same thing, where the value of written research is actually decreasing every day, and what people are starting to pay more and more for, and what's becoming more valuable, is that intimate, high touch, one to one or one to few experience where you're actually talking to the person who wrote the research. So I think written commentary actually is becoming less valuable, but people are writing written commentary in order to do two things: establish a ranking and establish a brand, which ties into your second question around quality, right? So now, you know, what is good content, quote unquote? I think that really needs another look for the industry in terms of how do you rate, rank, and kind of provide social validation on the quality of content and content producers. And really, you know, our whole view is it should be largely based on, you know, their actual consumption metrics. You know, who reads those people? Who are those people? How does that compare to everything else they read? And really let the industry, who they think the best content producers are globally on any given topic, you know, industry, name, et cetera. And I think what people end up doing more is, you know, starting to say, okay, I'm doing work on ABC company. I actually want to look up who's the smartest person on the name. I want to read some of their stuff. And then I want to basically hire them exclusively for an hour, a few hours, a day, a week, a month, or a year, even more.
Are you guys starting to think about how machines can consume your content, given that we're seeing a lot of AI-based trading systems and so forth emerge, you know, as the role of the broker in the trading scenario, sitting on top of an exchange changes? How do you build content that can be consumed by machine learning algorithms?
Again, there's a couple elements to that question. I think so. Number one, brokers are trying to become more data-driven on what content they actually produce, right? Making sure that the content they're producing is what their clients want to consume. You know, I think you see something like an earnings, you know, release, right? You know, Fortune 500 company reports earnings. Right? And I think companies are trying to move away from that. Well, we're going to write it because we feel we have to we're going to write what our clients want. You hear this kind of new term, kind of quote unquote, quantamental, you know, this idea of using quantitative tools. So quantamental is kind of this hybrid approach. It's okay, well, we still, as an industry or as an investor, as a fund, think there's a lot of value in fundamental research. We think, you know, short term it's a voting machine, long term it's a weighing machine, but we want to supplement the kind of fundamental process with quantamental data sets, quantitative data sets rather, to produce a quantamental view, right? So one of the kind of quantitative data sets you might want to look at is, you know, rankings of content producers. So you say, okay, I'm going to still do the fundamental work, but I want a quantitative view of who the best content producers are, or I want a quantitative view of how the market performs after X, Y, and Z happens. And I'm going to use that data in my approach, but my approach still has fundamental characteristics to it. It's not purely algorithmically driven. And I think what you're seeing is a kind of surge in this view where firms are trying to generate quantitative data sets for their investment professionals to use, but those investment professionals are still leaning heavily on the fundamental side.
So when you're looking at the way we measure the effectiveness of research, how is that changing as a result of, you know, just the mass amount of content and the way we access this stuff these days?
Yeah, absolutely. So the institutional investor community is not actually that big, right? Maybe a couple hundred thousand people globally. I mean, just to give you a view on how much content is being produced in this space, you know, one of the firms we work with in just equities, which is one asset class of many, you know, just equities and just research. So one of the content producing groups, right? The sales, the trading, strategists, everything else. They send out around 110 million emails a year. If you take that and use that as kind of a barometer, there is an insane amount of content being produced in this industry and distributed.
I mean, I don't know how anyone. I mean, maybe I'm biased because I'm getting like 1,500 emails a day on occasion these days, but I don't know how anyone still uses email as an effective tool.
Yeah, I think there's two big problems with email. The best description of email I've ever heard is it's a to-do list that someone else sets for you. And I think, you know, for the street, it's a to-read list that someone else sets for you, right? And it's this kind of tool that Wall Street's inherited, and it just doesn't work well, right? You know, we have many buy-side clients who receive between 3,000 to 7,000 emails a day, right?
Oof.
You know, it's impossible to stay on top of, and everyone's looking for a better way, right? But the big problem right now is this massive kind of, how do you know what you don't know? So people are scared of missing things that might be material to their position, so they end up subscribing to too many things. Right, and most of those subscriptions they have no control over, right? Because it's being produced somewhere, and they're just on an email list, so they're getting, you know, blasted all this content, and that's really one of our big things. So it's saying, how do you take the content consumption experience out of Outlook? And that solves two big problems. Number one, it solves the huge problem around usability, right? Outlook was not built to be a research management system.
Sure. Yep.
And because you're out of Outlook, you're not in your silo anymore, so you can see what your peers are reading, you can share with them, you can comment, you can collaborate. You can tag articles, you can do all this stuff. But number two, it solves the measurement problem, right? So right now, you know, this is overarching kind of MiFID II boogeyman of regulation happening out of the UK. Everyone's worried. No one knows how they're going to adhere to it. And basically, MiFID II is about preventing inducement. So what they want to say is, we want to make sure you're not trading with firms as a way to pay for research. We want you to pay for research, and we want you to pay for execution. And we want to make sure that firms are not giving you research as a way to induce you to trade with them. We want firms to give you research because they have the best research and you're paying for that. And we want you to trade and get best X with this best X. So the problem for firms is they're trying to measure all their consumption now, but Outlook is not built for content consumption measurement, right? So one of the hilarious things that we've already noticed is going to be a massive kind of Achilles heel, which I don't even think has been addressed yet, is Outlook tends to have an antivirus running on it, on Microsoft Exchange servers. And one of the things that antivirus likes to do is open up email and look at any link that comes in. So if you're trying to measure what content you're consuming from, you know, broker A, B, C, D, E, but Outlook is just clicking everything that comes in, it's really clouding that data. So you have no idea what a human's actually opening and what a machine's opening, right? So at the end of the day, you know, the broker comes to you and they say, hey, listen, like, we sent you all this stuff and you consumed it all. You owe us. And you say, well, I actually didn't read any of it, but the data disagrees with you.
Yeah, yeah. So talking about different asset classes, what do you think about all the ICO activity recently?
I think it's, you know, to be honest, I think it's very interesting. I think, number one, I mean, one of the interesting pieces of commentary that I read on it is it's overwhelming evidence that the industry is looking for better ways to invest in early companies.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, ICOs really provide that. You know, listen, I think it might just be a market reaction to the amount of regulation, red tape, and process that now is involved in, you know, doing a public offering anywhere in the world. you know, for better or for worse. Because, I mean, you know, with ICO, there is essentially none.
Well, there are a few. There are a few ways to list in different manners. Doesn't require a full IPO, like the gem market and so forth. You know, in Hong Kong and yeah, London, yeah. A similar one. But you know, we really do need a 21st century approach to this, don't we?
Absolutely. I think it's interesting too. It's only like an ICO. You're giving up essentially no equity value in the company, but what you're giving up is a proxy of the company's marketplace value. So where I think you see like the great ICOs is when it's linked to an actual product that has a marketplace behind it. Because then you're buying into the ecosystem. And basically it's like, hey, if someone launched a new country and that country was selling the currency, would you buy it? Right? And that's how I look at it. But the only difference with an ICO is that country can never issue more currency ever. Right? So you're buying a very fixed percentage of the total possible outstanding currency. Which is slightly different. But I look at it as you're basically investing in a new environment.
Great. So what are your plans for Street Context for the rest of the year? Where are you guys going with this?
Execution is really being commoditized across every asset class. Right? Some asset classes are much further ahead than others, but execution is very much a commodity, even when it comes to trading cryptocurrencies. Right? Execution is not the value add anymore. It's content and analysis and perspective. And we think Wall Street's moving from a data ecosystem to a content ecosystem. So we currently work on the publishing side heavily. We're now really getting ready for our kind of big buy-side launch. We already have a number of buy-side clients and investors around the world.
Did you raise some cash through them?
Yeah, absolutely. So we had just launched with a number of kind of early adopter funds, I would call them, just want to use technology to get an advantage. And they're like, listen, we'd love to be long-term partners. We'd love to support the ecosystem. And we want to become investors in Street Context. And what would that look like? And so we had a number of funds from the US, Canada, and Asia. Become investors. And so for us, it's just rolling out now the kind of other half of our marketplace, the buy side platform over the course of the next 6 to 12 months. And it's going to be kind of broadly available in a few weeks, actually.
Great. Well, congratulations. And let us know how the rollout goes. But thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Well, that was our first half. I wanted to take this moment to mention that we will be doing a live taping of Breaking Banks at the Mobile Payments Conference. Brett will be on stage with Travis Delaney of Push Payments and the Fed's Task Force on Faster Payments. Please join us and use the code MPCPUSH100 for a $100 discount on registration. We'll be back in one moment for more Breaking Banks.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air. Gravity, this podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the second half of Breaking Banks today. While we were in Copenhagen for Money 2020 Europe, we were able to talk to so many groundbreaking people. First, JP Nichols interviewed Lou Zarofsky, Solutions Practice Lead at ACI Worldwide, about the new world called open banking. Now, one note about their conversation, Europe was abuzz with the work going on around PSD2, or Payment Services Directive 2, a directive from the European Union about creating safer and more innovative payments from banks. So enjoy.
Well, we're here now with Lou Zarofsky from ACI Worldwide. Welcome, Lou.
Thank you very much. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Yes, I'm coping on day two. It's been quite frenetic, but still alive.
Did you have a late night last night?
It's more the early morning presentation and the late night start, I guess, yeah. So my voice is a little bit hoarse, but not too bad.
Yeah, you gave a presentation this morning?
I did, yeah.
What was that all about?
Oh, it's the global trend for open banking. different scenes of open banking around the world.
Well, that's been a theme on this show. We've talked a lot about open banking. Obviously, since we're here in Europe, a lot of conversation about PSD2, but it is beginning to head to the rest of the world in different ways. So what was your perspective on that?
Absolutely, yeah. It's, obviously most people are here, I think, to find out about this curious experiment of PSD2 and there's a regulatory drive for open banking. But there's a lot of chat in the corridors about how different open API based or open banking initiatives are taking place from places as far away as US or in India or in right. China. And you know, we now have this sort of common vocabulary of open API and open banking. Not all of it's driven by curious regulatory stuff. A lot of it is driven by banks just saying, well, actually, here's a new cool way of connecting to customers in a different way, using skills that we don't necessarily have in-house. We can go and do that connection through third parties using some cool technology.
Right. Yet it requires a lot of change, not only of the technology, but literally of the management, of the philosophy. We've been talking about too, that you really have to approach the business differently.
I've got this favorite expression about how, you know, APIs used to be a technology, but open API is a state of mind. And that applies to sort of open banking as well. You know, you kind of, a lot of people are sort of checking for what's the architectural model? How do we glue things together? And I think it's almost like there's no point doing any of that stuff unless there's somebody in the organization, whether it's a bank or a processor or a third party of some sort, that's actually saying, well, we want to do business differently. You know, we want to kind of do consumer services differently, or we want to embed ourselves in commerce differently.
Right.
So I think that mindset change is a big thing for me.
Oh, good. So what was kind of the key takeaway from your talk?
Get on and do it is the key takeaway. We have a
shoe company in Oregon that says something like that. Just do it.
Well, it's not quite as simple as that, but we have a lot of folk, and this is aimed at sort of a lot of the rump of Central European banks who are waiting for standards to emerge or waiting for direction on how to go and implement something like PSD2 in a box.
And, right.
You know, the kind of theme is, no, you don't need to wait for any of that stuff. You already know what the principles are of open banking and collaboration. You know what open identity or open, you know, OAuth 2.0 is. You know how to go and do these things. Don't wait for the actual final standards to emerge. They might not emerge for years yet, really. Just start playing now. So the thing is, just get your hands dirty and start playing with open APIs.
Well, look, I'm a recovering banker myself, so I get it. We like to follow rules. We like really clear rules spelled out to us line by line, and then we can check against that. Did we follow this? Yes, we did. Did we do this? And we're not quite there yet. It's been this much more iterative, collaborative process of some rules are made and people are moving forward, and
yep.
There's been some test and learn, certainly, which is something I think every leader and every, not only financial institution, every company needs to embrace more as a business philosophy. But it is a big challenge for people who are kind of wired to follow rules that are very clearly prescribed, isn't it?
And it's not just the bankers who are facing this challenge. You know, I come from a background in the IT consulting and implementation services type business. And there the game is always about trying to do a fixed price project for the most competitive price.
Right.
So, you know, colleagues in that industry are struggling with people saying, look, you're the experts in this. You can you help us define what the requirement is? And by the way, can you do it for fixed price? And of course, you've got this situation at the moment where
you know, you're exploring the unknown.
Yeah, nobody's going to go and underwrite a project in the traditional kind of systems integration community either. So it really is there's a necessity to sort of take a leap into that kind of new uncertainty world.
Right, because that works when you're doing a project where the outcome is fairly well known.
Yeah.
And you're kind of comparing how, you know, can we get to this pretty well-known destination as quickly and as cheaply as possible.
Absolutely, yeah.
But we're heading in a cardinal direction, but the actual destination is not really defined.
We're in a world of principles-based regulation and principles-based standards at the moment.
Right.
Yeah, you compare that to a standard like EMV for card standards. You can pretty well decide whether you're going to be compliant or not and whether you're going to get a certificate and a stamp and you're good to go. This kind of world is about, well, it depends on your policy, it depends on your risk profile, it depends on your interpretation of some rules which haven't even been defined yet in the case of PSD2. So the regulatory technical standards are still waiting to be approved.
Right, but, and then they'll be further refined by country.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's a mess. I don't mean that in a sort of negative way. I know it sounds bad from a former banker's perspective, but this kind of provides opportunities as well. People who are fast movers and able to get their hands dirty and start playing with things will make relationships and make connections and new channels to customers that will provide the bedstead? Did I say bedstead? The bedrock of their future business.
Well, I think that's been a recurring theme in our conversations today, and it's interesting to see it from a European point of view. And I'm glad to hear that you're also having conversations with American banks, because I spend a lot of time with American banks, and very few of them, in my estimation, are really thinking about open banking and API banking very seriously, and that needs to change.
I think the perception amongst European banks is there's nothing happening there because they have a regulatory view. But obviously, you have to remember, why are European bankers, or why is there a European policy to try and encourage bankers to go and do this? They look across at the US and say, well, actually, there's quite a lot of innovation happening in the US. You know, we've already got lots of competition and innovation at the same time. What can we do as public policymakers in governments and central banks to try and do something like what the US guys are doing? So I don't think the US is kind of way behind in this kind of area. There's a lot of leading banks that are already using API technology to underpin the kind of competitive edge they've already got. Clearly, it doesn't apply to all banks, but right. in the US.
Well, and we're also in a very unique situation with such a large number of banks, unlike really any other country where we still have over 5,000 banks, less than the 13,000 there were when I started my career, but we still have a lot relative to any other country.
I've lost count of the European ones. Are we talking over 4,000 that are going to be needing to do something with these BSD2 APIs?
Right. Well, that should be good for your company, right?
I should hope so.
So how are you helping them?
Well, we have a universal payments platform, which allows real-time connectivity on an any-to-any basis. So any kind of type of person, any channel, any type of payment instrument. And at the moment, given this level of uncertainty, we're trying to make sure that whatever systems they have in place that provide the stable 24/7 transaction processing for existing payment instruments, typically card-based, they can be extended and expanded to handle the new volumes from API-based traffic. And, if we look at Europe, are we going to see much change in terms of volume from card-based? Probably not. But we are going to see a whole slew of new transaction types, new methods of payments, in particular the immediate payments direct from account, where a customer's account can be debited immediately, and the creditor's account, including retailer banks, can be credited almost immediately. So we have some technology that allows that kind of immediate payment to take place, starting from an API initiation. And with that comes all sorts of support infrastructure in terms of making sure you can deal with the workflows, the disputes that will inevitably happen, the kind of like the billing, the fees, the settlement, all that kind of stuff.
Well, we talked about Europe. You're the consumer payments practice lead for EMEA. What about Middle East and Africa? What are you seeing there, and how are you spending your time in those other markets?
Well, actually, a year ago, probably nothing. Past year, there's been a hell of a lot of stuff happening, particularly in Asia. And two types of kind of initiative I'd point out. One, I'm going to focus on India just for a minute, actually, because India's kind of an unusual case. You know, this thing called UPI, the Universal Payments Interface, has popped up out of nowhere. It's API-based. Banks in India are going to be forced to do it.
Is that roughly analogous to the PSD2 we keep talking about?
On paper, it sounds almost like the same kind of thing. Banks are going to be forced to open up. But when you actually look at the technical details of it and the way in which the policy is operating, it's very different. You have a European model, which is very much about, it's almost like a, it's like a chaotic kind of principles-based, let the market decide how to communicate amongst themselves on a bilateral basis, and maybe standards will emerge. Whereas the Indian approach is like the Indian Central Bank says, these are the standards, you will all conform to this technical standard, don't have any of this debate, just go and do this. So as a result, the Indian banks and Indian payments is moving very, very quickly. When you have a strong mandate like that, people have to conform.
There's less ambiguity.
Absolutely. And, people are starting with they're doing a great job in terms of catching people who are previously unbanked and getting them into a situation where they can use payment type instruments. Not necessarily through traditional banking products, but through mobile-based applications. And it's being helped by things like Aadhaar, the Indian identity scheme system, which is by itself, that's a separate sort of success story. I mean, nearly 1 billion people have now been registered for a biometric identity scheme in the past couple of years, which is just extraordinary. So that's the Indian kind of model. We're seeing Singapore, in a way, kind of driven by public policy, trying to get inward investment, fintechs trying to grow their sort of stature in financial technology investment. We're seeing some beautiful playbooks being created by the central authority. These are the standard APIs we'd like to see so similar kind of centralist push as opposed to that chaotic
much
thing.
More directive.
Yeah, as opposed to what we're seeing in Europe and the UK as well.
Right. Well, it's great. Well, Lou Zarofsky from ACI, thanks for joining Breaking Banks.
You're welcome. Pleasure.
And finally, JP also interviewed Amita Malhotra, Chief Marketing Officer of Omniway, about how they are redesigning the retail store experience to reflect what we love about online payments.
We're here at Money 2020 Europe in Copenhagen, and Amita Malhotra, Chief Marketing Officer of Omniway, joins us. Welcome.
Hi, JP. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about Omniway.
Omniway, besides the fact that we just changed our name from OmniPay to OmniWay recently.
So what was the impetus behind that?
What was the impetus? Yeah. We started off looking at changing payments in retail. And we approached it from the issues that retailers are facing when it comes to mobile payments and digital payments.
Uh-huh.
And we felt that none of the wallets or payment schemes that are out there were really solving for what the retailers really wanted. Payments was never a problem. I mean, credit cards work.
Right.
You know,
we can get the money off of my card into your account pretty easily. So, that's not the issue.
So whether I swipe it or tap it, that's really not the issue. The issue is what card are you using to tap or swipe with? And definitely in the retail world, there's a hierarchy of which cards are lower in transaction fee versus the other. So we started off with that and looking at that as a particular use case and say, are retailers keen on having their shoppers pick a product that is lower cost to them? Definitely in that hierarchy, the private label card is way on top because that's actually a card that they actually make money off of, followed by the debit card, which post-Durbin actually has really, really low transaction fees on it,
right?
Followed by credit, which probably has the highest transaction fee to them.
Right.
Now, that's all one part of the problem. But then you start looking at the entire checkout cycle and you say, well, it's not just the payment piece. It's everything that's happening before that.
Mm-hmm.
So a typical user in a large retailer's physical store right now shows up, puts some items on the line, and then they start fumbling for their coupons, the rewards, the loyalty points, all that stuff they want to use, and grandma's gift card. All of that stuff needs to be applied before that final payment is going to take place.
Mm-hmm.
That takes time.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, the retailer spending time to give their shoppers a discount. Kind of goes reverse of what they're trying to do in return for their loyalty. They still want to do it, but they want to make it a little bit frictionless. So we looked at that and said, well, what if we created a rich checkout sequence in physical retail that matches what happens in an e-commerce environment? And who better to learn from than Amazon? You go to Amazon, you go there, I can pay with Amazon points, Amex points, gift cards,
split
it up in a different way, and somehow it'll bundle things for me. It'll give me all the offers I want. So let's take that and apply that into a generic retail environment.
That to a physical merchant.
Yeah, bring it to a physical merchant. How do you do that? Most payment mechanisms that are being proposed right now actually replicate the credit card transaction. So essentially, you go through this entire process, and then instead of swiping a card, you tap a phone. What we decided to do is let's take it to the start of the checkout process. So let's set up a digital connection between the user's mobile device, our cloud, the retailer's backend, all the way down to the point of sale terminal. So that anything that's happening on the point of sale terminal is being conveyed back to the user's device and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So while the items are being scanned, me as a shopper, I'm looking at offers, coupons that are being applied to items that are being scanned, as well as generic offers.
It's just like your merchant app.
It's through the merchant app and do it in a white label basis, allowing the brand to kind of customize this experience based on who the merchant is, which is really important to them. They don't want to be disintermediate in that customer relationship. So we started off with that, and that I'd say the acceptance on the merchants was fairly high. We started with a merchant that's been really ahead of the curve in terms of digitization, Kohl's. That's our first partner, and we decided to integrate this capability inside the Kohl's app, which have millions of downloads. And by the way, Kohl's also has a very robust private label program.
Right.
In fact, close to 60 or 65% of their store transactions take place on the Kohl's private label card.
How would that rank in the kind of industry norm?
They're way up there.
Yeah,
I think.
Well, what is the norm? Do you know?
I'd say it's less than 30%.
Less than 30%, yeah. And they're more than double of that.
Yeah, some of them are maybe even in the single digits in terms of the percentage. I mean, the type of programs there are. But I mean,
so did Kohl's kind of choose you, or did you go to them because of that high penetration?
Yeah, we worked out a criteria internally in terms of what's the ideal customer set we want to go after.
Right.
So our ideal customer set was private label card, definitely, because then we're looking at digital tender steering. Second is having a robust loyalty program, which Kohl's has with their Kohl's Yes to You rewards and so forth. And then having a some form of a cashback program, that's Kohl's Cash on top of that. And then having a heavily coupon-driven, offer-driven sales process, and which is another thing that they do.
So all kind of hit all your criteria.
Hit all our criteria, and then having a digital app and being serious about doing something.
And they said yes. So
because they said yes, so let's try it out. So we implemented that, and it's been very, very successful. So what we did with them is a shopper shows up with the Kohl's app. Step number one, if you're a Kohl's app user, any card you, any Kohl's card you have on file with them is immediately available for you to use inside the store. It's one click. You don't have to sign up. You don't have to add that card or anything. You open the app. You hit Kohl's Pay. Say, you want me to use the card you have on file? You say once, yes, and boom, it's in.
So that's for any card?
It's right now for the Kohl's charge card.
That's, okay, just
that's
for the card.
The okay. They want to get that pushed right. out.
So the plan, eventually, they'll have
they're thinking okay. about it.
Yeah. But given what you said, though, they you know, have lots of incentive to prioritize.
There's a lot of incentive to prioritize.
The Kohl's card.
Yeah, okay. There is. There All right. is. And it, I think it's that and the fact that a lot of the users tend to use it. And the best offers are tied to the Kohl's card.
Right.
So you want to use
it. And that wouldn't be unexpected to a customer.
No, yeah, right. It's not. And this is something that we were conscious about when we put the product together, the architecture of the product, is you have that window of time when I begin that checkout process where the user is now looking at, instead of looking at the point of sale device, instead of looking at the cashier, looking at, they're interacting with their mobile device. That's the only point of interaction that they have is the mobile screen, something that they're very comfortable with and something that they can look in their privacy in terms of what offers they have. And they can be presented with different card options that they have available. I know Jet.com did that when they were independent. I think they're still doing it, where they would give you discounts if you used a debit card versus a credit card. So think of it the same methodology applied inside a physical store, mm-hmm. Something that we call digital tender steering. So if you...
Digital what?
Digital tender steering. Okay. Within that same interface...
Tender steering.
Yeah.
Got it.
Within that same interface that's being presented to you, your payment card options are there.
Right.
Depending on the card you pick, right. It'll automatically recalculate
right.
what your discounts and offers
are. And they're steering you towards the method that works best for them.
And then the right. big down line over there, you saved so much today,
right.
will always show up on the most people.
You're trying to create a win-win.
Yeah, we right. are. So then, as we started doing that, we kind of found that, you know, this is not about just payment. This is the entire checkout cycle that we're improving. And we're seeing 50 to 60% improvement in checkout times. Just by doing that, not the payment time. That's like the last 2 seconds of the entire transaction. So this is pretty powerful. And we launched that with Kohl's, and they've gone nationwide with it, and it's called Kohl's Pay. As we started looking at that deeper, we said, you know, we are on to something bigger here. And that is that what we've done is we've connected the in-store experience through a digital layer for the shopper. So it doesn't just have to happen at the time of checkout now. They could actually walk into the store and an entire new digital experience can be presented to them, kind of like an augmented layer to their shopping, physical shopping experience. And that layer would replicate what they're used to in an e-commerce environment. Things like understanding who they are, understanding what their previous journey has been, creating a heat map of what they're doing inside the store, what are their preferences, where they browse, what time of day it is. You know, they look at an item, they could be offered a personalized price on that item that's specific to them for that time of day.
All those things you would experience with an online merchant.
With an online merchant. And all those things that inside a physical store get broken, because if I'm giving someone a personalized offer in the aisle, how does that translate all the way to checkout? We can do that because we've digitally connected everything together. So that's an extension of that.
So does this involve sensors in the store?
No, you don't. It's just depending on where you are, depending on the
device,
item,
just the device, geolocation.
Depending on what you're looking at, what you're browsing and so forth. And a lot of people tend to, you know, look at an item and check the price on it and see what offers and deals they have.
Right.
As they're going through that process, those things are being added up to what's happening to them.
Right. So you're building and recording and building on the customer journey.
So and then secondly, on top of it, when we started saying, well, why does the shopper really have to go to a checkout aisle?
Right.
If I've already scanned the item and I want to purchase it, it's already inside a virtual cart.
Right.
So I
right.
could just...
That's what I do at the Apple store.
Right. Of course, yeah. Right. I could now walk out.
Right.
And all things considered, you can self-checkout or do some kind of a assisted self-checkout, but it's maybe a guard at the gate who has a device and it knows whether you paid for it or not and so forth, and all that can work. So we created a platform with that capability. We've actually got that now. But this
so this is how you move from beyond payments
exactly.
to so
that's why the name changed.
OmniPay, now OmniWay,
yeah.
and you're really broadening that. So what you've just described there, is that launched already or is that still in development?
So it's actually the platform is ready to handle that.
You don't have anybody live with it yet.
We don't have anyone live with it yet.
Yeah.
So
have you had any betas with it? Have you
good customer? We've done a few.
Yeah. What have you learned? Because I'm imagining. I mean, this is on one hand super cool, but on the other hand, I'm imagining, you know, not every customer is going to love it, right?
Yeah. So there is a reason why shoppers come to a physical store,
right?
And there is a level of personal interaction that they want
or not want.
Or not one. Well, right. it depends. I mean, let's put it in perspective of a typical shopper journey. I come to the store. One of the reasons I'm in the store is I want to touch, feel, smell that particular product that I'm trying to buy. So that's part of it.
Right. It and might be something that I am choosing not to buy online because I want to try it on or I want to, just feel it, touch it, whatever. Yeah. Right.
And for us, we don't believe in an online-offline boundary. I just want them to buy from that retailer.
That's part of what you're doing is closing that gap.
Yeah. So it shouldn't be that, okay, I could buy this online. So that I'm in the store. If I like it, I could buy it there or I can have it sent to my house. There should not be a boundary between the two. I'm just going to buy it from these people. The second thing is there is a situation, there are certain types of retail segments where they want to be handheld. They want to be felt special because I showed up at the store. And what we're seeing a lot of times what's happening in these large retail scenarios was that the sales associates were actually spending most of their time manning the cashier versus spending time selling to the
Serving the customer.
Or serving or trying to guide them through the journey.
Right.
So as we talk about experiential shopping interactions, this is becoming more important. So I may not want the mobile device to be the concierge for selling stuff to me. I still want a human interaction there. But then the device is just an enabler in allowing that shopping journey to be completed. There's another thing that's been happening, and you guys are pretty familiar with what's going on in retail in the U.S. It's not been a good year.
Right. A lot of closings.
Yes. One of the reasons for that is retail is overbuilt. It's significantly overbuilt in the U.S.
Yeah.
Someone gave me, it's like, 15x of the U.K. per capita in terms of real estate used by retail. And the reason for that is large retail started off in a pre-e-com era where you had to cater to every nook and corner of the country.
Right.
And you had to have a big
location,
store
location,
there.
Location, location, location.
And you had a big mall and everything. So now with e-com and the fact that you can actually deliver goods to someone, so you don't need that big footprint anymore. So what you could do is reduce the footprint of the store, carry your anchor items, carry items that are, one-off in terms of, size, fit, and something like that. And then the variations of that items in different colors and all that could be available at a centralized warehouse. So a lot of retailers starting to look at that. So as I get into the self-checkout side of things, and now start looking, if I scan an item, we could say, hey, you know what? Yellow, but blue is available in warehouse. I can send it to you. It'll be home by the time you get there.
Right.
That kind of stuff.
Right.
So that's where we're beginning to evolve as a company.
Yeah. It's amazing. And we spend a lot of our time thinking about fintech, and increasingly that's starting to bridge more and more with commerce, not just e-commerce, but now physical commerce.
Yeah.
Well, Amitabh Malhotra, thank you for joining us, and we look forward to hearing a lot more from OmniWay.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, that covers another episode. Remember to follow us on iTunes, and thank you for joining us on Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.